Portions of the day's programming are reproduced by means of electrical transcriptions or tape recordings.
It's time for school. Rock school. With your hosts, Dr. Joe Burns.
I heard that the Army tried to draft Frank Zappa, but they couldn't because he was a pornographer. Is
what?
That true?
What?
Is that true? Yes.
Oh, no!
And Chad P.
Why would you grow a beard in July and August?
You have a beard?
Yes, but I have a beautiful beard.
Class is in.
Hey, good afternoon. You, the radio audience. All five of you out
five
there sitting out there in the radio audience. We can see you through the microphone. This is Rock School. My name is Joe Burns. Sitting next to me, Ted Nugent.
Ted Nugent.
Nice beard you're growing.
Why
there.
Why is everybody giving me flack about this beard?
Why would you grow a beard in July and August?
You have a beard?
Yes, but I have a beautiful beard. I'm a handsome man. You, on the other hand, are you hiding something? Do you have something to hide?
No.
I don't know. Sitting next to me, what's your name?
Chad P.
Don't grow a beard in August. It's woof. Or keep it nice and trimmed. We're going to have to take you out like the dog. Get you shaved down.
You make it sound like I'm Moses over here.
Let me tell you, the jokes. They're trying to come out all at one time. Before we get into the topic of today, let me run something past you, ladies and gentlemen. I saw a documentary this weekend, and I want to sort of tip it off to the audience if you like this kind of stuff. The documentary was called Shut Up and Sing.
Who's that about?
The Dixie Chicks. It was when Natalie Maines was in London in the early 2000s.
Oh, when they were spouting off all that stuff about the president?
Right, when she said we're embarrassed that the president is from Texas.
Mm.
Here's the thing. Whether you like their music or not, immaterial to the topic of the show. What's really neat about the documentary, and from a rock school perspective, it shows how the idea of a song is created, how it goes to a multi-instrument format, how it's recorded, and then how it's promoted. And that's really neat to watch because it shows radio's involvement in the creation of a hit,
mm-hmm.
or how radio's uninvolvement can basically destroy a group.
Yeah.
And how this group, the Dixie Chicks, actually sort of circumvented country radio because they had a number one album literally not using country radio at all. They
mm-hmm.
basically said, look, if you're not going to play us, we're going to circumvent you completely.
Yeah.
And it was really a neat thing to watch because you got to see them take these songs from idea, then run through these different producers, and it was just really interesting to watch. Whether you like their music or not, fairly immaterial. I don't dislike them. Not the first thing I reach for, but still, really interesting. So it's called Shut Up and Sing.
Cool.
Head to your Netflix, head to your Blockbuster. And if you can get a hold of it, it's a decent hour and a half, and you get to see a little bit of behind the scenes. I had no idea that the Dixie Chicks would curse as much as they did.
What?
Little potty mouth Natalie Maines.
Wow.
Here is the topic for today.
What are we talking about?
There is the book. I pulled it off of my shelf.
Let's see.
Gavin Edwards is the author. Do you know what magazine he writes for?
Rolling Stone.
Good for you.
Yeah.
For about 5 years, Gavin Edwards wrote a column where people wrote in with questions.
Mm-hmm,
say,
mm-hmm.
Gavin, answer this. And he would answer the questions. And
what?
This is... Go ahead.
You can't say the name of that
I'm
book.
I'm going to.
That's...
You can bleep it if you want.
Wow.
The name of the book is Tiny Dancer Really Elton's Little John? That's the name of the book. Music's Most Enduring Mysteries, Myths, and Rumors Revealed.
So it's not a topic about Elton John.
No, it's just one of the questions.
That's one of the questions.
Right.
Okay.
So I've gone through it, and I've grabbed about 15 questions out of the book that deal with music that we would play on Rock Show. I have a couple ballads in here as well, because we don't normally play ballads on this show.
No,
but there's a couple
as a rule,
ballads.
We don't.
Well, there's a couple of ballads that have really good information to
okay.
it. So,
excellente.
Here's the first one.
All right.
This is from Gavin Edwards' book. Question.
Mm-hmm.
I heard that the former bassist of Iron Butterfly was an innovative scientist who was killed after people found out that his research that objects could go faster than light was true. Is that true? Was he really killed? Was he? Huh? Huh?
I say negative.
No, probably not.
Okay.
Philip Taylor Kramer was his name. Played for Iron Butterfly. Born in 1952, joined the Butterfly Reunion in 1974, recorded a couple forgotten albums. You know it. Inagata Davida. It was supposed to be In the Garden of Eden, but they were really soused when they sang it, so it came out Inagata Davida.
That's really good.
When the group broke up, he got himself an engineering degree, worked on the MX missile, of all things, and later specialized in video compression. In 95, Kramer stated that he had developed a formula for instantaneous transmission of matter.
What?
This guy believed he could shoot you anywhere in space, not outer space, but if you were standing in Boston and you wanted to go to, say, Chicago, he could go boop, boop, and send you there.
Wow.
That quick.
Okay.
The problem is he was starting to go a little fruity in the loops.
Uh-huh.
And he was beginning to make statements that the Earth was about to be consumed by a supernova.
I just caught that.
Sorry about that.
Fruity in the loops.
He also stated that he was married to Mother Earth.
Oh,
on
wow.
February 12th, Kramer called a 911 operator from Los Angeles' International Airport, told the operator he was going to kill himself and that O.J. was innocent. He later
make sure y'all
vanished,
knew.
Just so you know. And then he vanished. Disappearance, of course, fueled talk of foul play, alien abduction, and that his thing worked.
Yeah, about to say, maybe he just took himself on over to the Caribbean or something.
1999,
uh-huh.
Couple of hikers found his body at the bottom of a 200-foot ravine in Malibu, California. Apparently, he made good on his threat of suicide. So, no, he did not, you know, find this thing. But was he killed or did he commit suicide?
I don't know.
You don't know. It suggests he was mentally unbalanced, but did he or did he not? I don't know.
Hopefully he's not remembered for that. Hopefully he's better remembered for being the bass player for Iron Butterfly.
Should know that I'm loving you.
Back from 1968. The Iron Butterfly. A lot of people believed, along with Blue Cheer and Steppenwolf, that was the point at which psychedelic produced heavy metal. There you go. We move back to the book, Gavin Edwards, page 129.
Okay.
Help! I have never been able to make out the beginning of the second verse in Van Halen's Everybody Wants Some, and there's no lyric sheet on the album Women and Children First. It sounds like a tickle mobilina looking for a mookie.
What?
Or sheepalada peppa dabba labba foo meme.
What? What are you talking about?
Okay. We've backed the song into around about
154.
54 into the song. Here's the lyric that people are a little concerned about. Go.
Here it comes.
What? Let me tell you. Now, you go ahead and get that queued up.
I'll get it.
When I was in high school, this is when guys and women were actually playing their records backwards. Remember the backmasking show that we
sure
did?
I sure do.
And people believed if you couldn't understand the lyrics forwards, that somehow backwards it would say something Satan-y.
Lord, I don't tell them
right.
What it says.
Well, we played it backwards. It was just as indecipherable backwards as it was forwards. What do the lyrics actually state?
What is Gavin's take?
According to this, he actually contacted David Lee Roth, and David Lee Roth said, quote, "Sometimes it's just attitude. We were revved up in the studio. I was supposed to sing the lyrics, quote, I've seen a lot of people just looking for a moonbeam."
Okay.
So even if he had said the lyrics, they don't really mean anything. They're just kind of blah, blah, blah. He said, but we were so revved up that sometimes certain things just shouldn't have too much meaning, like Saturday night. So it really means nothing. So here you go. Halen's Everybody Wants Some. That means something on Rock School. Ow. take it down. Hurry up.
You know, I was thinking a while ago.
He curses. Bring it down.
It's down. It's down. I was thinking a while ago. You know, you're sitting there with your little Ted Nugent beard joke.
Yeah, what about it?
You probably have been wanting to throw something like that on me ever since back in, like, 01 when I was your student.
Oh, when you made
fun of me. You tried to grow
me.
That Frank Zappa handlebar mustache, yeah. And I called you Wyatt Earp.
I remember that.
You've been wanting the revenge ever since.
That still bothers you? We're 20 minutes away from me calling you. And I called you. It's not like I called you a lesser name. I called you Ted Nugent.
No,
goodness.
I'm not flattered to be called Ted Nugent. Oh. But you just took one look at me like, this is, whoa, hey, Ted Nugent.
The topic of the Rock School show, if I can bring us back to square one,
right.
Is a brand new book here by Gavin Edwards, at least brand new to you, the audience. Is Tiny Dancer really Elton's Little John? It's a bunch of questions that were sent in to Gavin Edwards when he was writing a trivia column. And question next.
What?
Did Chevy Chase play drums for Steely Dan?
What?
Yes.
He did?
Yes. Well, not really. What, kinda? Yes, maybe?
Dude, you're confusing me.
Donald Fagen puts it this way. Donald Fagen, the main songwriter and keyboardist for Steely Dan.
Okay.
Quote, "We went through college with Chevy Chase, and we never thought of the idea of putting Steely Dan together,
mm-hmm.
but we used to do pickup dates with Chevy Chase on drums.
Mm-hmm.
He's actually a very good drummer."
Cool.
Filling in the statement with some more detail. The institution that they went with was Bard College in upstate New York in the late 60s. Fagen led a band that cycled through a bunch of names called the Don Fagen Jazz Trio Bad Rock Group, which I think is a great name, and Leather Canary.
All right.
I know those are silly, but think of Steely Dan is not exactly a step up. Fagen recruited Walter Becker, who was 2 years younger than he was, hearing him play in a blues guitar band in a student lounge. And Chevy Chase was one of a variety of drummers that was used to fill out that group.
Yay!
Becker and Fagen then left on their own and a little later on formed Steely Dan.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of up to you. Did Chevy Chase really play with Steely Dan, or was he just one of the early drummers with Walter Becker and Donald Fagen?
I'd just go ahead and say yes, because I think you were in Steely Dan. According to the photo,
if I'm not mistaken.
According to the pictures on our website. So
as Walter Becker says, we're Steely Dan. He's not. Here you go. Steely Dan, Asia on Rock School. Shutter Falls, you see it all. Did you, the backup singer, by any chance, were you listening enough? Did you hear the voice of the backup singer?
I did, but I couldn't make
Michael
it.
Michael McDonald, who went on to be the lead singer of...
I can't help you.
Doobie Brothers.
Oh!
Doobie Brothers, yeah. He did backup singing for them. By the way, I think I introduced that by saying, here's Steely Dan and Asia. The album... Asia. That's Peg.
Okay, not
Peg
the band
was the
Asia.
Name. No, it was Peg.
Gotcha.
And now that I think about it, I think I think that Peg was actually on Gaucho.
Really?
Man, did I screw that whole thing up? Let's take a break while I sit around here and bang myself in the head with a hammer. Back in a minute on Rock School. Hello, radio audience.
Are you back?
I'm Joe.
Are you all right now?
This is Chad.
Hi.
He has a beard.
What?
We are doing a show here where we're looking at a book off my library shelf. I have a bunch of rock and roll books. This one by Gavin Edwards. He used to answer trivia questions that the readers would send into Rolling Stone, and he put a book together.
Rolling Stone's version of Dear Abby.
Yeah, pretty much. Here's one.
Okay.
I told you we were going to play a couple ballads during this show because the information about the songs were, I thought the information was really fruitful.
You
and
did.
I thought we should play a couple
Speaking
of them.
Being fruitful, that's how I looked at you.
James Taylor.
Uh-huh.
I heard that in college some friends of James Taylor flew his girlfriend in as, you know, a surprise.
Yeah.
But her plane crashed.
Oh, my gosh.
And that was the reason he wrote Fire and Rain.
Mm-hmm.
Any truth to that? You say?
I'm going to call false.
True.
Whoa.
But a little bit.
What?
Fire and Rain was inspired by the death of a female friend of Taylor. Her name was Susie Schnurr. S-C-H-N-E-R-R. I'm probably pronouncing that incorrectly.
Okay.
S-C-H-N-E-R-R. I'm not sure how to do it. But Taylor never went to college. Schnurr wasn't a romantic interest and tragically committed suicide.
Ah.
Taylor's friends didn't tell him that she had died until 6 months later because they didn't want to rattle him while he was recording the album Sweet Baby James. Hence the song's line, "They let me know you were gone." Listen to this. The song that everybody seems to know, he wrote the first verse of Fire and Rain in his basement apartment in London, the second verse in New York City in the hospital where he was hospitalized because of a heroin addiction. Then he wrote the third verse in a Massachusetts psychiatric clinic because he was trying to keep himself off of heroin. So this guy that you go to see and you think, oh, nice, sweet, he was a heroin addict. So there.
The
so
things you don't know.
When you listen to Fire and Rain, it's a whole lot deeper than you think it is. Here's James Taylor on Rock School.
Just yesterday morning, they let me know you were gone. Suzanne, the plans they made put an end to you. I walked out this morning and I wrote down this song.
James Taylor, Fire and Rain. You didn't know it had so much background to it, did you?
No.
I'd like to know a lot about a lot more of his songs. Not like Mockingbird or like, but I got a feeling a lot of his songs, because of his heroin addiction, probably have a lot more to them than you think they would. He has another song called, I think it's called It's a Wonderful Ride, where he talks about, you know, you've met middle age and you're on the downslide. And I think it's a wonderful piece of music.
Cool.
I really like James Taylor.
The things you learn with a little bit of research.
How about that? Welcome to the bottom of the hour. Say hello to our wonderful syndicate partner, ladies and gentlemen, if you would.
88.1 FM WESU, Middletown, Connecticut.
We forgot to say hello last week. I apologize. I apologize profusely. It was my beard. My beard made me do it. I'm sorry. The bearded men in the radio. Go to the Rock School website, kslu.org. Look for the... I told him I wouldn't make fun of his beard off air, so I have to make fun of my own. Look for the Rock School chalkboard on the right. Click on it. See pictures of us with beards. Write us an email. Ask us to post pictures of our beards. Go ahead, Chad.
KSLU Rock School at gmail.com. KSLU Rock School at gmail.com.
The Stump is going to be on the good people of...
The good people.
Of
Guns N' Roses.
Guns N' Roses.
When I saw them in the playlist, I was like, let me just see if I can pull up something that maybe could stump Doc. And...
I love Guns N' Roses.
I liked them a lot, too.
What I liked about Guns N' Roses is During the 1980s glam rock, everybody was playing 64th notes, just brrr, a million notes a minute. And they, not grunge, they didn't do it grunge ways, but they came out with good, clear 70s-esque classic rock. And, you know, when Slash played his solos, it wasn't a million notes, but it was Clapton-esque. It it wasn't how many notes he played, it was how he played the notes. And I remember hearing Welcome to the Jungle, and it was that, I have this sort of this picture in my head of the whole music world looking one way, and when grunge came out, you know, when you heard Smells Like Teen Spirit, the whole music world turning and going, what's that? And you know, the hip-hop world, I think, has stagnated. You know, every rap song to me is, you know, I look good, women love me, I go to the club, I drink Cristal. That to me is every rap song, and I'm waiting for that next rap artist to do something.
So Shake things up.
Right, so the whole rap world will go, what? You know, and turn and say, oh, look at that. And I think that's what Guns N' Roses did. And again, they, like most great groups with two or three, you know, Axl Rose, Slash, they blew themselves apart.
Yep,
they had two great things together.
They did.
Here's the question.
Okay,
here's the question from this. The spaghetti incident. What in the world does the spaghetti incident mean?
Because it's the spaghetti incident with a question mark.
Right, and it's in quotations. The correct way to do it is quotation, the spaghetti incident, question mark, quotation.
All right.
Here's the story.
What?
Duff McKagan tells it, bassist for Guns N' Roses.
Yep.
When they were first together, the five first people that you know, and there's a lot of people in Guns N' Roses, but the main five, Steven Adler was the drummer, and apparently he was doing a ton of cocaine at the time, and he used to keep his coke in the refrigerator.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, they were also eating a lot of Italian takeout.
Mm-hmm.
They were eating so much of it that Adler used to refer to his cocaine as spaghetti.
Gotcha.
So the joke went that "give me my spaghetti" meant "give me my coke."
Mm-hmm.
Well, when Adler was kicked out of the band, and again, what do you have to do to get kicked out of Guns N' Roses? Hey, Slash, quit shooting heroin into your eyeball. We're having a band meeting.
Yeah.
Steven, turn in the paddle. You're not GNR material, you know? So when Adler gets kicked out of the band, he then sues Guns N' Roses, stating that his heroin addiction was, get this, their fault.
Oh, yes.
And when they were in court, onto the stand goes Duff McKagan, and up this lawyer comes, looks him straight in the face, and says, "Mr. McKagan, can you tell us about the spaghetti incident?" And that's where it came from.
There you go.
That's where it came from. There's a lot of other stupid stories, but according to Duff McKagan, that's where it came from.
Steven Adler, as you know, was fired when they were doing Use Your Illusion 1,
right?
Because it took him like 30 takes.
Yeah,
to do a song.
He was
so spaced out.
Bombed, yeah.
And so they got rid of him. Well, we talked about there are a lot of people in Guns N' Roses.
Here comes
the stump. That's actually the stump. Between former members and current members, can you tell me how many people can honestly say, "I play in or I have played in Guns N' Roses"? I will give you a minus or plus two handicap.
So I got a 4 either way.
You can come within 2.
Are we starting with the five members on? We're starting with the five members on Appetite for Destruction.
Yes.
Okay. Adler leaves. One comes in. We're up to 6. New drummer. Izzy leaves. Comes back. That's 7.
Mm-hmm.
7 leaves. Comes back. We're up to 8.
Mm-hmm.
The band blows apart. Axl Rose splits. Bring in Buckethead and the whole thing. That's 4. Comes up. I'm up to 11. 7 leaves. Come in. 10. I got 14. I got 14.
Is that your final answer?
14 is my final answer.
21.
No kidding.
21.
Really?
Look, there they are. Look at all of them right there. Axl Rose, Dizzy Reed, Robin Fink, Tommy Stinson, Chris Pittman, Richard Fortus, Brian Mantia, Bumblefoot, Frank Ferrer. Those are the current members. Then you got Slash, Buckethead, Paul Tobias, Josh Fries, Duff McKagan, Matt Sorum, Gilby Clark, Izzy Stradlin, Steven Adler.
And on they go.
And on and on and on they go. 21
yeah.
people.
You got it's because he's got doubling of instruments, and Buckethead only played a couple times with him, once live on MTV. I got up to 14.
You
at least
did
I
good.
Got somewhat close.
Yeah, it's a shame that a lot of them just don't live and let live.
Live and let live. Or like Chinese Democracy, which is going to drop every day.
Any minute now.
Yeah, live and let die.
You were young. This ever-changing world in which we live in makes you give in and cry.
Yeah. It's missing the French horns. It's missing the French horns. I like the French horns in it. I like the Paul McCartney version better. You know. And have you ever listened to the Spaghetti Incident? It's all covers.
It is all covers.
Yeah, they do a good job with Nazareth, Hair of the Dog, but I'm not a fan of, you know, like they did with the New York Dolls songs. I'm not a big fan of the album. I own it, but not a big fan of it.
It's all right.
We're dealing with the book here. Is Tiny Dancer really Elton's Little John by Gavin Edwards?
Are we going to answer that question?
Do you want to play...
Actually, I'd rather not even touch it.
No, okay.
It doesn't matter.
Did the Yardbirds' Keith Relf get electrocuted on stage by an electric guitar?
What?
Did the Yardbirds' Keith Relf really get electrocuted on stage by an electric guitar? That's the question. Did he, yes or no?
I say no.
No, he didn't.
Okay.
He did it in the privacy of his own home. In fact, it killed him. Relf was the singer of the Yardbirds for 6 years while an array of guitarists, you know, Clapton, Beck, Page, rotated through the ranks. He died May 14th, 1976. There's an urban rumor, urban myth, if you will, that he was playing electric guitar in the bathtub.
Mm.
Okay, nobody's that stupid.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he wasn't in the bathtub. He was in his basement, and he was basically practicing, sitting there doing his scales. He was barefoot. He was on a cement floor surrounded by metal pipes using malfunctioning equipment with bare wires, and he basically put his foot down, and his foot had, you know, sweat.
Yep.
Sweat has salt in it. Salt, water, metal pipes completed the circuit. The electric current went through him, and at age 33, bup, that's it.
Wow.
That did it. You'll hear about a lot of people who were shocked on stage. As a matter of fact, the Grateful Dead,
mm-hmm.
and when they played at Woodstock, were shocked numerous times
really?
On stage, but never, obviously, killed.
Yeah.
Ralph actually killed, but the train kept a-rolling all night long on Rock School. One originally by Tiny Bradshaw.
Woo!
From the 1965 album Having a Rave Up. That's Jeff Beck on the guitar there. And your favorite group, Aerosmith, did a stunning version of that one.
They're always talking about it in that book that you loaned me. I mean, I'm reading just about every other page.
How far are you through that?
They're fixing to split up.
Oh, that's too bad. That's too bad.
I read a little bit at a time.
It goes bad in that one. Yeah, Walk This Way, I think, is the name of the autobiography of Aerosmith. You'll enjoy that when you get the whole way through that one. And you're just starting. When that one's done, you then have Scar Tissue.
I have Scar Tissue, the complete story of Anthony Kiedis of the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
And when you're done with that, I'll then loan you Hammer of the Gods, the Led Zeppelin story.
Cool.
Oh, they're great books. Great, great books. And those of you out there, if you're looking for a real good book to sort of kill the rest of the summer with, any one of those three will do. I haven't read Scar Tissue yet, but I've been through the Aerosmith and I've been through Hammer of the Gods, and both of them are fantastic reads. We got to take a break. Back in 1 minute on Rock School. This is Rock School, ladies and gentlemen. As we move through Gavin Edwards' book, Is Tiny Dancer Really Elton's Little John? It's just basically a grouping of the questions that Gavin Edwards used to answer. For 5 years, he was with Rolling Stone answering questions in a column, and I've got a bunch of them here. Yes.
What is Mr. Edwards doing nowadays?
I don't know. I assume he's still writing for Rolling Stone, but I never actually took the time to take a look, and I'm looking at the rundown. See, this is copyright 2006, so I got to believe he's still writing for Rolling Stone.
Okay.
I got to believe. Question next.
All right.
Has any band been together as all of its founding members longer than U2? All of its founding members. Formed in 1978 at Mount Temple High School in Dublin, the four members of U2 have now spent an extraordinary 30 years together.
It's a long time.
Has that been the longest?
I will say yes.
No.
No.
UB40 has had their 8-man lineup just as long.
Mm.
Los Lobos has been 35 years.
Mm.
Now, there are people that have gone even farther than that. The best way to guarantee that a band acts like a family is actually to be a
family.
The Osmonds have been together longer.
Mm-hmm.
The Neville brothers have been together 31 years,
mm-hmm.
And counting, obviously. Barry, Maurice, and Robin Gibb had been performing together since 1958, which means they were together 45 years before Maurice's death in 2003. However, if you're looking for the band that has been together the longest that is not a family. They are not related.
Okay.
38 years.
Who?
That little band from Texas.
Who's that?
ZZ Top.
Hey!
And you know what they wear on their faces?
What?
Cheap sunglasses on Rock School.
When you wake up in the morning and the light has hurt your head, the first thing you do when you get up out of bed,
is hit that street running and try to meet the masses. Go get yourself some cheap sunglasses.
But what really knocked me out was the cheap sunglasses.
Mm-hmm.
ZZ Top. Right here on Rock School, a little band from Texas, together longer than any other band.
That's very impressive.
Yeah, it
very
really
impressive.
Is.
Because
Frank
when you
Beard.
Start dealing...
When had you, to throw it in.
I know. When you start dealing with all of the pressures of the road and the success and all that kind of stuff, it's really hard to stay together now.
It really is.
Without
really
changing
is.
Lineups or breaking up and getting back together, but they did it.
Yeah, VH1 Classic is showing one of their latest. It's a 2008 concert with them. They have turned their microphone stands into smoke stacks, like on the top of a truck and such, and they don't move around a whole lot on stage anymore. They're getting up there, but
that's
I'll tell
okay.
you what.
You don't
they,
have to.
They reproduce the music very, very well. Well,
question.
We're in our last break. What's your question?
Well, I know that we're going to end with Frank Zappa, so
right.
I just got to know. Is Tiny Dancer really Elton's Little John?
Oh, you want to hear the answer?
I'd
to
like
the question?
To hear the answer. We're not going to do the song, but I'd like you to look it up if you could.
126.
What does Gavin say about this?
Okay. Elton John's Tiny Dancer. Okay. He contacts Bernie Taupin.
Okay.
And Bernie Taupin laughs, quote, "That's great. I wish people would actually tell me what they think the songs mean, but that's not what it means. I wouldn't belittle myself. So, however, your friend is closer to the truth than he or she thinks." Taupin emphasized the song wasn't about any one specific woman. However, it's about women in general that we met in California mm-hmm. in the fall of 1970, where, quote, "sunshine simply radiated from the women when we were there."
Okay.
Quote, "I was trying to capture the spirit of that time, encapsulate the spirit of the women that we met, especially the clothing store women up and down the strip at L.A. They were free spirits, sexy and hip huggers and lacy blouses. They were very ethereal, the way they moved, so different than any woman that I had ever met in England. All they wanted to do was crochet and sew patches on your jean. They would mother you and feed you and talk to you and make you very happy." Then Gavin asks him, "Why Tiny Dancer then?" He said, Bernie Taupin said, "Poetic license, it fit. They were all petite and lithe and pretty, and Tiny Dancer sound better than Small Dancer or Little Dancer."
Okay.
It simply rhythmically fit the music. So
fair
there
enough.
You go. That's
fair
what
enough.
I wish it meant more.
Yeah, it's okay.
I wish it meant more.
We're going to wrap up here with Frank Zappa.
That's
and
right.
This is going out to Steve Portier, our engineer, who is
Frank
a
Zappa.
Zappa fanatic. So go.
"I heard that the Army tried to draft Frank Zappa, but they couldn't because he was a pornographer. Is
what?
That true?
What?
Is that true? Yes.
Oh, no!
Frank Zappa served
Frank?
Time on a pornography charge when he was 23. Here's what happened. Zappa was playing with a blues trio in a Latino club in Ontario, California, where the crowd was more interested in watching the Go-Go Girls. A used car salesman walked up and said, "Look, I have this sex tape. Can you please create some audio to go with it?" And Zappa, which didn't have any money, said, "Yeah, sure." So he created this music to go behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And what he did was he also had a young lady come in and make some noises and such. The problem was the used car salesman was Sergeant Jim Willis of the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Office, who was running
no.
a sting operation. Zappa was charged with conspiracy to manufacture pornographic material. The problem was he had absolutely no money for a lawyer. The lawyer that they were going to give him didn't have any idea what to go on, so he pled nolo contendere and served 10 days of a six-month sentence. The bad part is he had to go to jail. The good part was when the draft notices came out for Vietnam,
he got a free ride out.
He was a convicted felon, and he couldn't go to Vietnam.
Hey!
We're going to finish with Joe's Garage, ladies and gentlemen. That wraps up the show. Thank you, Gavin Edwards, for
Thank
putting
you.
The book together. It's a wonderful read. A lot of the ones who are in here, I couldn't show to you because they're...
Yeah.
My name is Joe Burns.
I'm Blackbeard Pete.
Class is dismissed.
There was just enough room to cram the drums in the corner over by the Dodge. It was a 54 with a mashed up door and a cheesy little amp, with a sign on the front said Fender Champ and a second hand guitar. It was a Stratocaster with a whammy bar.
make a jam and Joe's Garage.